Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today's special guest is back with us once again. It's Patrick Bernau. Welcome, Patrick.
Hello.
And Patrick, this time we are going to continue delving into the mysteries of Belgium, but very specifically, probably one of Belgium's most famous tourist destinations, the lovely city of Bruges.
That's fine, yep.
And as it just so happens, Bruges is probably also probably one of Belgium's most famous mystery sites. And there is an entire layer to that city which people have really not seen or appreciated, and which you, as with everything else you've been doing with the mysteries of Belgium, have pushed to the surface, so to speak. And this has also resulted in a novel which you and I have co-authored, which the English title is translated as Satan's Pope. And this basically starts with a very interesting little nudget tucked away into a very famous book, a very controversial book written at the end of the 19th century. Joris Karls Huysmans writes a book, Le Bas, which he believes he has identified a priest who is the most evil priest ever, gives him a pseudonym, and then soon afterwards it turns out that this is the priest who lives in Bruges and who is the person who is actually the caretaker of one of the most precious relics in Christendom, the focus of a yearly procession through the streets of Bruges, which all three of us have actually witnessed, though unfortunately never at the same time. So, to start with the first bit, the famous book of Huysmans, what is there to say about this?
Well, it's translated in English as Down There or The Damned. It's in both ways translated. And it's not a novel. It's a novel too, but it's also a history of Satanism. And it's what we would call now faction. It's facts and fiction. It's also very autobiographical. It's about Joris Karls Huysmans, his own life. And Huysmans was a French writer. He has a Dutch name because of his father was Dutch, but his mother was living in Paris. And in 1891, he already was a very famous author. He was in the circle of Zola, the man, the naturalist authors. I don't know if you say that in English, naturalism. It's a genre in literature. And he was known as a very decadent author, but he hadn't published already on subjects as magic or Satanism. And in this book, in Down There or in The Damned, he wanted to face this topic. And in this book, he is writing about Gilles de Rais, the famous French marshal, the fellow companion of Jeanne d'Arc, but also the man who had black masses and who sacrificed a lot of young people. He came also, Satanism in history was Gilles de Rais, but it came also to attack Satanism in present day, end of the 19th century. And there was, in his book, it's called Canon Docre, and this Canon Docre is celebrating black masses, and he's one of the most sinister features in history of literature, I think. And people were asking, this man, is he real? And some people said it was Joseph Antoine Boulan, also a very famous black priest, you could say, who was involved with all sorts of magic in those days. But Huysmans immediately said, no, it's not about Boulan. Boulan is in fact, let's call it a white priest. Is a basically a good man, but this canon doctor, he is in fact the chaplain of the Holy Blood, the chapel of the Holy Blood in Bruges, and he is the more than a Satanist, he is the Satan's Pope. He has a cross tattooed under his feet, so he is able to walk always on the symbol of the Savior, and he is leading all sorts of black masses. He is into black magic too, and he is as you said it already, he is the caretaker of one of the most precious relics in the world. And this relic is kept in Bruges, in the Chapel of the Holy Blood. It's indeed the Holy Blood. This book is basically upon this chaplain of the Holy Blood of Bruges, Labba.
And indeed, to just go a bit and put this in its framework, because the Huysmans book really was a phenomenal piece of material. It was written as fiction, but as you say, it contained facts. And what was happening was actually extremely interesting, because the book began to describe something which was happening in Lyon, France's second largest city, but also said to have been at that moment in time the esoteric capital of France. And in there you had various doctrines, Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, Martinism, various kind of Gnostic churches, all coming in and sprouting up, and all fighting amongst each other. And there's an extraordinary amount of intrigue to happen there. And you have people like Philippe de Lyon, who is a very famous healer, who's in there. And then obviously the most famous of all, probably Papou, Dancos, a doctor of Lyon, who really took charge of this entire movement and tried to steer it in a certain direction. And so you have all of these gigantically big characters. You've mentioned Boulin, Jules Bois. All of these people are part of this extremely volatile mix. Mm-hmm. And it's total chaos even now. Whenever you see books about Freemasonry or the French movement, it's so complex, and there are hundreds of names and hundreds of things. And really, the reason why it's so chaotic, but also the reason why we know of the chaos, is largely to do with Huysmans' book, because he was the one who dragged it from secret corridors and secret rooms and Freud's amongst friends, which never got any airtime and definitely were never reported in newspapers. But he brought it out into the open and said, this is what's going on France's esoteric scene.
Yes, one of the most interesting pieces of this history is the Black Magic War, huh? And Huysmans was in the center of it. You had on the one hand you had Boulan, who was casting spells and all sorts of things. On the other hand, you had Stanislas de Guaita in Paris, who was also casting spells, who had his own spirit. And Huysmans also became involved in this war of the black magicians, you could say. And he said the most dangerous of them all was not Boulan, was not de Guaita, was not Peladon. He wasn't to be found not in Lyon, not in Paris, no. The most dangerous of them all was Louis van Haken, chaplain of the Holy Blood in Bruges. It was also the period of another famous novel by George Rodenbach, It was the time of the symbolist writers, and Joris Karl Huysmans also was some sort of involved with symbolism. But you had Joris Karl Huysmans, you had George Rodenbach, and George Rodenbach published in the same period, a year later, he published Bruges la Morte, where a very mystical work, very poetic, about this medieval city of the dead, that was Bruges. Bruges is indeed, it's a very old city. It's a medieval city. It's a city of mysteries and mystic. And in this novel by George Rodenbach, there is a widower. His wife has died, but in this city of the dead, he sees an actress, and she's like, she's his wife. She is resembling her very, very strongly. He thinks she's some sort of reincarnation of his dead wife, and he starts following her. And Rodenbach was a friend of Huysmans, and all these stories with Bruges in the center of it made it the city of Bruges in one time very, very famous. People out of Paris, people out of London came to Bruges to visit this city of the dead, and also to see Louis van Hake, the chaplain of the Holy Blood, who was called Satan's Pope in that scandal-making novel written by Joris Karl Huysmans. So, end of the century, 19th century, Bruges was, you could say, the mystical heart, the black magic heart of that time and that period.
Okay, I want to jump in here for a second, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. This story is really, in so many ways, a quintessential European story, and I think that a lot of Americans are not familiar with it. So I just want to provide a little bit of context for my American audience and say that, you know, this chapel, for example, the Holy Blood Chapel in Bruges, is an incredibly powerful and meaningful place, and contains one of the great relics of Christianity, which is a piece of cloth that wiped, that is said that Joseph of Arimathea used this cloth to wipe Jesus' face with, and that it has some of the blood from Jesus on it. This vial with the holy blood comes back in the Second Crusade, and this church essentially is built to house this relic, correct?
Yes, that's entirely correct. And I would say more. There is one known, very strong, very old legend stating that the Holy Blood, and you could say also the Grail, came to Bruges. It was found on Christmas Day, 1148, and it was found by the Templars. The Templars in the Holy Grave in Jerusalem, they found a vial with this holy blood in it. And who was there with the Templars in the Holy Grave? Well, the Count of Flanders, Derek of Alsace, together with his wife, Sibylla of Anjou. And now, that couldn't be right. Sibylla was, in fact, at the moment, she was in Hainaut. She was fighting Baldwin of Hainaut. But
right. So, and I just want to interject, Sibylla of Anjou, a fantastic warrior female character. Go on.
Yes, that's it. And for some reason or another, the people who were writing this legend down put her in Jerusalem. They wanted it there in Jerusalem, and they said she was together with Derek of Alsace when they found the vial with the holy blood there in the holy grave, and they gave it to her. And Sibylla was at the moment she was a leper, and she suffered from terrible attacks of fever. And when the holy blood was poured from the jar they found it in, into an other bottle, an octagonal bottle, and the ends were sealed with two golden roses. Well, she held that precious relic in her hands, and then in a vision she saw a new Jerusalem of the West. And she said, this new Jerusalem of the West, that's the city of Bruges. She saw it before her eyes. She said, this city has to be a holy city, and this holy blood has to be in this holy city. And at the moment, she was cured, and all the lepers around her also. And Sibylla, together with Draco Valzas, came to Bruges. They came to the Chapel of the Holy Blood, and as by coincidence, the Freemasons had just finished the Basilica of St. Basilius on the Burg Square, and the Chapel of the Holy Blood was ready to keep and to have this Holy Blood, to have this precious relic there. And from that moment, the Sanguis Christi was venerated in this Chapel of the Holy Blood. Now, other documents say the Holy Blood only came to Bruges a century later. But in fact, that doesn't matter. What's more important is what the Templars wanted to be, who the Templars wanted to give this relic to, and who the Templars wanted to where the Templars wanted to keep this relic. And that had to be Bruges, and it had to be the Count of Flanders, and it had to be Sibylla from of Anjou, because there was a story behind it. It's no coincidence also that the son of Derek of Alsace and Sibylla of Anjou was Philip, was also Count of Flanders, and he was the patron of Chrétien de Troyes. And it was Philip, the son of Derek and Sibylla, who brought the Holy Blood to Bruges. It was Philip who commissioned Chrétien de Troyes with writing the Grail story. And it was also Philip who gave Chrétien de Troyes a source book to write the Grail story. So there is in Bruges, there is, with this Holy Blood, a very tight connection between the Holy Blood and the Grail story. In fact, Bruges is some sort of Grail city. And for me, the Chapel of the Holy Blood is the Grail castle.
It's definitely, I mean, first of all, there are very few relics. When we're talking about relics, most of them are either to do with saints, and the very few who have to do with Jesus Christ are quite often relics of the Passion. There's obviously no body to go around, so you can't have a relic of the body, but the closest thing to that is blood.
Yeah.
So for Bruges to have this is obviously extraordinarily important. And I think it's actually, please, the both of you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Bruges is one of the few and definitely the most notorious example of a Holy Blood relic in existence today, which has survived from that.
That's true, and there is more, because there are other Holy Blood relics, but they aren't documented as here the Holy Blood in Bruges. The Holy Blood is in Bruges. We can still see it, and there are all sorts of documents about it, writing about it since the 12th century. So since the 13th century, there is a procession of the Holy Blood. It was there undoubtedly in the 13th century, and that's very important, because all these other places who claim to have a relic of the Holy Blood don't have such a rich history, aren't that documented as the Holy Blood of Bruges. And still, the Holy Blood is very famous today. If you go to the procession, we have seen it. Well, there are masses of people who come to the procession and come to see the Holy Blood. And every Friday, still, the Holy Blood is venerated. You can touch it. You can see it. It is showed to the people in the Chapel of the Holy Blood.
And it's a precious relic, as you say, but also the accounts suggest that up until a few centuries ago, something extraordinary happened to the relic, namely that it became liquid on mm-hmm. certain times of the year.
Yes, and it stopped. They said it stopped to become liquid when the Templars were had their difficulties in the 14th century somewhere. Mm-hmm. But
go ahead.
What also is very important here that it's not only the Chapel of the Holy Blood. The Chapel of the Holy Blood is very important, but there's also the Jerusalem Church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Bruges, and that's also a very strong mystical place. If you go there, it's a very small church. It's said to be a copy of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, and it's also the same idea of Bruges has to be a new Jerusalem, has to be a new Jerusalem of the West. When we lose Jerusalem to the Muslims or to whatever, we still have this new Jerusalem of the West. That was the idea. Bruges had to be some sort of Mecca, some sort of holy city. Pilgrims had to come to Bruges. And it was in Bruges also. That was the reason why the Holy Blood had to come to Bruges. And because it was the Holy Blood of Christ. And it was not only the Holy Blood, it was also the secret, and I am convinced that this is what explains all the legends and all the stories that are told about this Holy Blood and Grail and all sorts of stuff. The secret of the Holy Bloodline is also in Bruges. And this Holy Blood in itself is only a symbol for a very for the secret of the Holy Bloodline. And the heart of that secret for me is in the Jerusalem Church, where you find a crypt, where you find a copy of the Holy Grave, where you find a statue of Christ, Christ the King, with his crown, very morbid also, and where you find in this Jerusalem Church a very there are three enormous crosses and depictions of skulls presenting Golgotha, the place of skulls, and you see there ladders and bones and whips and nails and hammers that are the instruments of the Passion, the arms of Christ, the Arma Christi. And it's a very strange and morbid place, but it's also a place full of symbolism. It's a place saying Christ, Jesus Christ, isn't dead. He still lives. He is the king of some sort of United States of Europe. He is a priest king, and he's still living. In his children, and that is what makes Bruges so terribly an enormous place to you have to feel it.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And I have been lucky enough to be in Bruges with Patrick and witness this Holy Blood procession. And I have also been to both the Jerusalem Church and the Holy Blood Chapel. And they really are extraordinary. I mean, my life my work is about crawling through Europe and looking at these kinds of churches and symbolism. And I will say I have never seen anything quite as compelling and as powerful and as fascinating as the Jerusalem Church in Bruges. It is truly a place full of symbolism and secrets.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I mean, just to add, there's like a quite a substantial piece of the True Cross there, and it's put on display relatively prominently in the kind of like crypt chapel. Yet, kind of like, you know, nobody is aware of it, that it's there. It's the entire church and then its treasures are so understated. And there's actually a very interesting, I think, exchange of ideas. You've been pointing out how the statue of Christ in his tomb is there in the Jerusalem church. But the original statue is actually in the crypt of the Holy Blood Chapel. So there's this quite interesting dynamic going on between those two churches, which you would definitely not see or observe just by walking around Bruges or by reading their individual booklets or their history. And there's also something, I think, which I've always felt interesting, and kind of like it's going back to kind of like when you're saying Bruges is a grail city. There's something very interesting, and it's kind of like rooted in basic economics, but also I always think basic economics quite often are able to hide things, and this is that the entire Renaissance, the luxury of the Renaissance, the luxurious goods in which the Florentine merchants became so wealthy about, had to do with Bruges and Scotland. And it was the fact that the wool, the sheep, were in Scotland. They were transported to Bruges. They were reworked there, so to speak, and then they were shipped to Florence, where they were sold and or resold. And there's this entire industry going on. Some of the Adornis family definitely went to Scotland, but also these families were always, as the name suggests, the Adornis, were people who had been put there by the Italians, and in some cases by the Medicis themselves, to really make sure that the economic interest happened there. Now, let's go on to a slightly bigger, not a conspiracy thing, but the notion that we know that these relics were always transported from one place to another. Just imagine the dozens, the hundreds of shipments of wool and other products being made between places like Scotland, very close to a place like Rosslyn, for example, Bruges, as we said, and then Florence, and then mix that all in with the material Kathleen is writing about in The Poet Prince, and you kind of like see how really you have almost like very obvious systems or roads going across the world, whereby straightforward economics and grail mysticism, so to speak, go hand in hand.
Yeah, there is what you say. There is a very strong connection between Bruges and Scotland, as you depicted it already. But indeed, the builder of the Jerusalem Church in Bruges was Anselm Adornis, and he was a diplomat, and he worked with the Scottish King James III, and James III brings us with William Sinclair, and William Sinclair brings us with Rosslyn Chapel, and it was also in Scotland that Anselm Adornis, the man who built the Jerusalem Church, was killed in a battle, and his heart is now in a mausoleum in the Jerusalem Church in Bruges, but his body is still somewhere in Scotland.
He actually died from where I'm sitting right now. He died a few miles away in the Battle of North Berwick in the 1480s, and his body is buried actually in St. Michael's Church in Linlithgow.
Yeah.
So going slightly towards the Jerusalem Church, Kathleen, when you visited the Jerusalem Church, one of your immediate impressions was that this was very much a place of twin soul energy, and definitely the way Adornis and his wife are posed in the middle of this church is a very powerful statement to that effect.
Oh, I absolutely. And of course, you know, my immediate thought is This is about family. This is about, you know, it's very specific that it is the two of them and how together they are. And there are elements in the church that I felt. And for me, that felt very much a statement of a Jesus and Mary Magdalene connection, which you also see throughout the church in a number of other ways. But I felt very strongly that this is a bloodline chapel par excellence. There, you know, if ever there was a shrine built to the family of Jesus, I really think it is this church.
Yeah.
And of course, I write about the order of the Holy Sepulchre in my books, and the fact that this church is named after the sepulchre. I believe that this church was built by the order of the Holy Sepulchre, which existed to protect the bloodline.
Yeah. You find the symbols of the order of the Holy Sepulchre everywhere in the church of the Jerusalem church in Bruges. That's very, very, very true. Yeah.
And so what we have is one of the most precious relics in Christendom, which is obviously placed under the protection of a chaplain. And then we find at the end of the 19th century, when we have such illustrated, very famous figures today as like Baron Gessonnière in Rennes-le-Château, who is said to be going to Paris and gets himself involved into this occult environment. We know he went to Lyon and he injected himself into that environment as well. But what we find is really, again, a very precious relic in Bruges, protected by somebody who could be what we today would call a Satanist or an occultist. And we see his name coming up in a story whereby it said, like, you know, that there's lots of black magic happening. So several questions here. One, was Van Aken really a Satanist, or was he just misunderstood? Was he really a part of this? And what do we feel this black battle or this black magical battle really was all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, there is no doubt that Hasmans was in a black mass in Paris. He was in the same circles at the same time with Saunière and with all these other people. For instance, the famous playwright Maurice Maeterlinck, who won the Nobel Prize in 1911. He also was at that time, he was writing, as he said himself, Merovingian plays. And he was at the same time, together with Emma Calvet and Debussy, and Debussy has put music on one of his plays, Pelléas et Mélisande. They were all at the same time in Paris. But they have also a connection with Flanders and with Bruges or with Ghent. And there is no doubt that Huysmans witnessed a black mass in Paris. He was working for the Sûreté Générale, the Department of the Interior in France. He was some sort of agent, not all that secret, but you know, also a secret agent. And he has seen Van Aken there, but it's not sure that Van Aken was performing there the Black Mass himself as some sort of Satan's Pope. Van Aken later said, or asked at Huysmans, "Don't I have the right to be curious?" He asked. He said, "Who told you I wasn't there as a spy? Maybe I was spying there." And I think there is some truth in it. I think he wasn't Satan's Pope. I think Huysmans misunderstood. And Van Aken was, in my opinion, he was preparing some sort of second coming. And the Satanists, at the same time, were preparing also some sort of coming of the Antichrist. Because if Christ was in Bruges, if there had to be a second coming in Bruges, if Bruges was the new Jerusalem, it was a heaven on earth, Satan had to be there too. And I think some Satanist circles were preparing the coming of an Antichrist. And I think it's all connected also with the story of Jack the Ripper. There is the cipher of 8 has a very strong symbolism, and Jack the Ripper was first time the people heard about him was in 1888, 3-8. And I think there Huysmans misunderstood. Van Haken wasn't Satan's Pope. Van Haken was fighting Satan's Pope. That's what I think. Now, there is some... Van Haken also published a book. And that's a very curious book, because this book, The Chaplain of the Holy Blood, Chapel of Bruges, published in French the fourth edition of a book called The Precious Blood of Bruges. But it's in very many ways a very strange book, because not only because of what has been written down, but also because of what the chaplain doesn't write down. For instance, he starts his book on the Holy Blood with some pages on the topic where the name Belgium comes from. And Belgium is derived from the Belgae, and the Belgae were the most belligerent people Caesar said he knew. And this reminds us, this etymology reminds us of another priest, namely the friend of Abbé Saunière, of Fresnel Château, Henri Boudet, and his strange etymology of la vraie langue Celtic. What has the etymology of Belgium has to do with the Holy Blood? Nothing, nothing. There is a chronogram code in this book. Why is there a chronogram code in this book? A chronogram, when you decipher the code, it's only a year in it. It's the year 1900, and that's the year when the fourth edition of the book, The Precious Blood of Bruges, was published. But why there is this simple chronogram in it? Well, Van Haken wants us to know this is a book that has a code in it. No? And when you start reading it, it's very strange that in this book about the precious blood of Bruges, Van Haken, who was a man who knew all sort of esoteric and occult theories, who had to know all these legends and all these documents about the Grail and the coming of the Holy Blood to Bruges, well, he doesn't say a word about the Grail. He mentions the Templars only once. And regarding the Holy Blood, both the Grail and the Templars are so significant, but he doesn't say a word about it. The Holy Blood was brought to Bruges by the Templars and the Count of Flanders. He doesn't say a word about it. The son of the Count of Flanders, also a Count of Flanders, Philip, commissioned Chrétien de Troyes with the first Grail story. Well, he doesn't mention it. That's the question here is why he doesn't mention it. He mentions some all sorts of arch heretics. He mentions the Orphist cults, but it doesn't mention the Cathars or the Templars, and that's so very strange. And then there is another thing. Van Haken has, out of the blue, there is some sort of hidden reference to Nostradamus and his quatrains in it. But what has Nostradamus to do with a book about the Holy Blood? Well, nothing. There are some pages, out of the blue, Van Haken says something about Saint Yves, who was a Breton, who was a lawyer, who was coming from Brittany, and the difference between someone who is coming from Brittany and someone who is coming from Normandy. But that's put in a quatrain. But this has nothing to do with the Holy Blood story. Nothing. And there is a quatrain of Nostradamus in the 9th century, quatrain 7. That's also about the difference between someone coming from Brittany and someone coming from Normandy. And I ask myself, is this Van Haken wants us to know, wants us this to say, you have to read Nostradamus, maybe. I think, and that's very important, I think, that you indeed have to read Nostradamus to understand what's Bruges all about, but also to understand what that other famous place in Belgium, namely Orval, is all about. Because Nostradamus writes extensively about Orval, and it's all in the same story, it's all in the same framework, it's all about this bloodline thing. Yeah, so that was a long story.
No, but a very good and very important story. And of course, anytime that you mention Orval, I'm excited. And it is, you know, this is, Belgium is like the forgotten secret. It's like the best kept secret in esoteric history. And that's what's extraordinary about it.
Yeah.
But okay, so going back to this idea, so you're saying that you do not believe that he was really Satan's Pope. You don't believe that, you know, because my question originally was going to be, you know, did he want to become the chaplain of this incredibly important sacred holy place because there was some way in which he was corrupting these energies or attempting to utilize this power, which is something that we see in the dark side of French history, dating back to what was happening in Louis XIV's court. But you don't believe that to be the case. You believe that something entirely different is really happening with him.
Yes, I do, because there isn't one single evidence that this man, Louis van Haken, was practicing black magic. There isn't one single hard evidence. There is only the words of Joris Karel Huismans. And Joris Karel Huismans wasn't always that, he wasn't always telling the truth. He was a writer. He was writing facts and fiction. He was melting facts and fiction together. And one evidence he had, there was the story of this woman, Berthe Courrière, and she was a friend of Joris Karel Huismans. She was the mistress of all sorts of politicians and generals and artists. She was the mistress, she had been the mistress of Clasinger, the sculptor. And she was obsessed by priests. She wanted to seduce priests. And this woman, Berthe Courrière, was in 1819. She was 38. And she was found near the house of Van Haken, naked and giving signs of insanity. And she declared she had fled the house of the chaplain of the Holy Blood because he was performing strange rituals, because he was doing strange things to her. But what could this chaplain of the Holy Blood do? Shock a woman with the experience of Berthe Courrière. She was immediately taken to an asylum, and she stayed there for some months. Her clothes were found in the house of Van Haken, and I always have asked myself what happened there. She had all sorts of experiences with sexual magic or sexual rites and all sorts of things. I think she also misunderstood Van Haken. Van Hagen was performing some rituals, I think, but not in the black magic way. No? But she thought he was doing that because she was a friend of Huysmans. Van Hagen was performing some sort of believing in the philosophy of the the Hieros Gamos, the mystic marriage, and she didn't understand that at that moment. She later understood, and Huysmans, he never understood, I think.
And to some extent, I guess Huysmans was also there. I mean, even 130 years after the events, what happened in Lyon really hasn't been explained at all, and it remains a very very problematic subject. And I think even in, it was one of these cases where if you were in the middle of it, it actually didn't help because you actually couldn't distance yourself from what was going on. And to some extent, Huysmans was the explorer. And I always think that explorers should be given slightly more credit in the sense that they have seen certain things, they are reporting things, but they are the first person to report, so to speak, as to what is going on. And therefore, they quite often get certain things right, but their extraordinary power and extraordinary value lies in the fact that they have spotted this as the first people around, whereas nobody has seen what was going on before. So where does this leave Bruges? Where does this leave the holy relic in Bruges, the holy blood? Where does this leave Van Hagen? Kathleen was implying, if not stating, that there was very quite substantial indications that what is happening in Bruges is part of the order of the sepulchre, a place of refuge, a place of safeguard of certain precious relics. When we look upon the history of Bruges like that, does that make any sense of other things which are happening in that city, or are there other things about Bruges which you feel really need to get mentioned and which haven't been mentioned so far?
Well, Bruges has been was the Venice of the North. It was the Venice of the North until the 16th century, 15th century, and then there was some sort of decay. Bruges was forgotten by the world because it had no harbor anymore, because it was all becoming under sand, I think in secret there were secret societies who were performing still these rituals. When you read about the history of the Relic of the Holy Blood in Bruges, you see that there is a brotherhood, a secret society, a brotherhood is formed to guard the Holy Blood, I think. The Holy Blood, and not only the Holy Blood, but there is also this piece of the True Cross in the Jerusalem Church. People needed them to perform their rituals. They were very important for all sorts of rituals, not only for black magic, but also for other sorts of rituals. Bruges was the place where all these secrets were kept. You have to know that in Coxide, that's maybe not 30 miles from Bruges. Coxide is at sea. The rule of the Templars is kept there. The original rule of the Templars. The first headquarters of the order of the Templar Knights was in Ypres. That's also in the neighborhood of Bruges. Bruges was in the heartland of all that sort of places, of all that sort of strongholds of the Templars. One of the founders of the Templars was Geoffroy of Saint-Omer, and Saint-Omer also is not far from Bruges. So that's I think that's one part of the story. When you read in the 16th century, there were the wars of religion, and the Holy Blood was in danger, and the Holy Blood was hidden somewhere in Bruges for some time. During the French Revolution also, the same story. People wanted to steal the Holy Blood, but the Holy Blood was hidden. And the Holy Blood also was the center of some miracle stories. People were miraculously cured with the Holy Blood. There was a story of a very great fire who was, the Holy Blood saved the city then, people said. So there is a very strong and long history with this Holy Blood in the middle of it, and Bruges also in the middle of it.
Absolutely, and it kind of gives a dimension to Bruges, I think, which kind of give very few people who go there on a daily basis know. But one person who we haven't mentioned, and you kind of became the first person we spoke about in your first interview, which for people who haven't heard, they can go onto iTunes or the BBS archives, and it's available there. It's a few months old. And we were talking about a person who came to Bruges, Jan van Eyck. And one of the aspects of Jan van Eyck, which I think we haven't really sufficiently mentioned, is that we give the Renaissance an awful lot of credit for this beautiful art, and obviously Kathleen's book, again, The Poet Princess, is all about these artists. But the same infusion techniques, the same nitty-gritty way of creating oil, was also known to a person called Jan van Eyck, who lived in Bruges. And it's actually him who's kind of the if you were to say, out of nowhere, oil painting and Van Eyck seem to have come to a story and an enormity, which only the Renaissance in Florence then was able to equal. So there seems to be something there in Bruges which attracts these people, but then also which really transforms them into something. And that obviously is a very Grail-esque aspect, if you want.
Yeah, you mentioned the Renaissance and Florence. Well, you could say in some way that there is also a connection between the Flemish primitives and Jan van Eyck was maybe the most famous of the Flemish primitives, but there were also others, Memling, for instance. Well, there is a strong connection. If there is a strong connection between Florence and the Renaissance, there is a strong connection between Bruges and the Flemish primitives. And all this work of works of mystical secrets. The dark side of the moon, if you would call it like that, was also represented in Bruges. In our book, there is the story of Félicien Rops, painter from the 19th century, but he was in his way also many, many, many years later, also some sort of Flemish primitive, but he didn't paint the dreams, the mystical dreams of these Flemish primitives. He painted the dark side of the moon. It was the other kind of primitive painting, you could say. And that's what attracts me also to this city.
Patrick, I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier in the interview, because I'm really interested in this, and I just want to get your idea and a clarification on it. I think it's fascinating when you talk about the importance of the year 1888, because I have also done a lot of work on that, and how much activity there was in Europe, most of it very dark. There were a lot of very ugly things happening in Europe in 1888,
yep.
A lot of underground, dark, blood-related black magic, that type of ritualistic stuff. And you mentioned the fact that this is the rise of Jack the Ripper in England at the same time. Do mm-hmm. you believe that there was actually a connection between the Ripper murders and the things that are happening in Europe, or do you think this is strictly an energetic issue, that there was just so much of that happening throughout Europe? Or do you think there's a real connection?
No, I think there is a real connection. I think the people who are involved with, on the one hand, with Second Coming, with the Great Monarch and all that sort of stuff, with Second Coming of Christ, and on the other hand, there was this Antichrist business, and Jack the Ripper was on that side, and I think Van Haak was on the other side, and Huysmans was in the middle of it, and he didn't know which part he belonged to. Philip said it also. He was an observer. He observed all sorts of things, but he didn't understand them all fully. He tried to understand it, and I think that can't be no coincidence in this Jack the Ripper emerging in England, in London, and at the same time you have all these circles in Paris, in Lyon, in Bruges. There are all these books written, all these stories, and okay, there's some difference, but I think it's all centered around these two pole positions. On the one hand, this Christ story, and on the other hand, this Antichrist story.
Well, I'm fascinated by this idea and of them together.
And I wanted to mention some other guy. That's Edouard de Bus. Edouard de Bus, people have forgotten him, but he was a poet, a black poet, dark poet, and he was also writing in the same time. You had all these writers like de Villiers d'Adam. You had Barbet d'Aureville. You had all these writers, and they were also writing in some Edgar Allan Poe sort of stories, but very, very European. And that's really it's fascinating stuff.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, we have once again run out of time. So we are at the end of another edition of The Spirit Revolution. Patrick is on his second interview. So again, you can go into the BBS archives. You can go to iTunes, and you can go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com, to see not only his previous interview, but also all of our previous interviews, more than a year now, archived on iTunes. So until the next time, from the two of us,
the truth against the world,